It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome back, listeners out there in Radioland. I hope you're ready for another great episode of the program we call Alaska Tracks. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I'm the host of this program, where we listen to excerpts from interviews I've recorded with veteran outdoorsmen from around Alaska. Today's episode will be split between two men, Yoar Sovland of Hoonah and Ken Fanning of Yakutat. We had a full half hour of Yoar last week. There was enough left over to fill half of today's program, and it was just too good to waste. I hope these split programs aren't too confusing. Today, Yoar shares stories about some of the giant halibut he has caught over the years. He then goes on to talk about moose and goat hunting and wraps up with the value of his outdoor lifestyle for him and his family.
Well, as I look around, I see a few other things, including a picture here of a giant halibut. Tell us about that one.
That held the state record for 18 years. That was cut on a point of Dolphus in 1978. Being alone on the boat, after fighting it for probably an hour and a half, 2 hours, finally did manage to get a rope through the gills. So I towed it into a buying scow, and it was too big to get in the scale, so we decided we would cut it first. You get a halibut that weighs 440 pounds dressed, and the first thing you're going to lose, you cut into, you're going to lose a whole bucket of blood. And then when you cut it up and all the stomach content, anyway, it did weigh 440 pounds and held the sport fishing record for the state of Alaska for 18 years till somebody finally got one bigger. The length of his fish and mine was identical, 97 and a half inches.
So do you remember any more of the details about this fight? I mean, you said you fought him for an hour and a half. You must have had just a real strong fishing rod.
The rod is just above your head there.
It looks like a broomstick.
Yeah, it kind of does. It's a spruce limb. No, those are homemade. They're very strong in 300 yards, 100 pound test. I had two of those. I commercial fished for 40 years, and when we were salmon fishing, when we anchored up, we always had a halibut line over, one on each side. And sometime you'd luck out and get a big halibut. I have one more just like that, but that one is retired. But the funny part was the very same year we were hand lining down by Mud Bay, me and my oldest boy, and we cut one on a hand line that weighed 466 pounds. We took him in whole and weighed him, but that wouldn't count for a sport fishing rig.
Now, when you say hand lining,
that's what they normally did have when they fished halibut, a hand line. Usually they have a stick with two hooks on it, and they put a weight on it, and they sit there, some kind of jigging line. Mm-hmm. But that was normal for fishing halibut, a hand line. They hardly ever used a sport rod for that, which they do nowadays.
So then did you have to pull the line in by hand too?
Oh, yeah.
Well, how long did that take?
Well, that didn't take too long. That fish was identical, the same length too, but we took him to the cold storage and had him weighed officially under cold storage scale. He weighed 466 pounds, but this one dressed the very same length, only weighed 440. I remember one time, like spring of the year, king salmon fishing is slow, and that we were trying to make a few bucks somehow, and that year I think that the halibut was $2.15 a pound. Go around and look for shallow, rocky spots and catch big halibut. I remember Pleasant Island that 1 week we had to borrow block and tackle from somebody three or four times to get the fish aboard. In fact, we were in Glacier Bay Labor Day. I forget what year that was. We cut one by Strawberry Island that we couldn't get aboard. My kids were small. My wife was not strong enough. So we decided we'd tow it into the lodge at Bartlett Cove. So I get in there and there was a guy on the float. I asked him if he would give me a hand and pull a halibut aboard. And he said, oh yeah, no problem. He just took one look at it. He said, no. He said, I think we're going to need more help. So he went to the lodge, and the next thing I know, there was 200 people that were watching this operation. Started up the hoist, and the halibut weighed 382 pounds. Oh, yeah, we had a few other ones, too. The ranger at Park said that's the biggest one they had ever seen cut in Glacier Bay.
How about mountain goat? Did you ever get interested in chasing them?
I got a goat over there.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of a sad deal. In the early days here, in the summertime, the hillside was just white with goats. I mean, sometimes they looked like pearl on the string when they were walking around the mountainside. Sometimes 30 or 40 in a bunch. We used to go hunting. I mean, that was quite common that we run across that and shoot a goat or two. And I don't think they were the best eating, not as good as deers. But then we used to do it. Then after statehood, something happened. The wolf took over and the goat almost totally disappeared. Nowadays, there are hardly any goats left at the mainland. In fact, that's a permit area. You have to get a permit before you go hunting. But when you fish on the home shore in the area, you hardly ever see a goat anymore. I mean, they're almost totally gone.
When you talk about running up the hill to get these deer, that sounds like a challenge to me, but the goat must be an even bigger challenge.
Yeah, goats are always tough because they were always in the roughest country. There is no mountain that I know steep enough that a goat couldn't hang out there. You could find them, but you couldn't always get to them. And if you did shoot one and he come off of the mountain, it wouldn't be worth it anyway.
We've been looking at some photographs here, and there's some interesting ones from a moose hunting trip up to Yakutat. Why don't you tell us about that?
A friend of mine was part owner in the cannery at Yakutat at the time. That was back in the late 60s. He had a little plane, and he offered to take us moose hunting. So we flew around, and we got down to Elsack River. This was back when there was no restriction against hunting and flying. The same day, we saw this moose on a sandbar. We were four people in his Live 172. He quickly turned and side-slipped it. Well, he probably side-slipped it too much. He lost too much airspeed, so when he hit the ground, it was kind of a hard landing. Anyway, the plane just kind of hopped a couple of times and stopped, and I hopped out of the plane and got the moose. That was the idea. And then we looked at the plane. The first 8 inches off the blade was totally bent over. Landing gear was spread. We could see that there was no way we were going to fly it out. He had some friends flying a plane packing fish from the rivers to the cannery, so he called them on the phone. Within 15 minutes, this old Pilgrim, single-engine, big plane, dropped in and taxied right up to the moose. He said, "I got just a few totes of fish in the plane. We'll just take the moose in the plane, and we had only five people." And so come along comes out, and we hooked down to the antlers and hauled the moose in, got the five people in, and taxied down through the gravel, and off we went to Yakutat.
You never even gutted it?
We didn't gut the moose till we got to Yakutat. A truck showed up, and they took the moose out of the plane, took it down and hung it up, and we gutted it.
Why did the pilot want to do it that way?
I don't think the pilot wanted any blood in this plane. Mm-hmm. He said if you just leave the stomach in, it's just a short hop to Yakutat, just not leave it in there, leave it whole. And that we did. I would assume that's probably the only moose that got a ride in a single-engine plane whole. You know.
Well, that's a great story. There's a photograph on the wall behind you of, I assume, you and three of your buddies with a bunch of geese. Why don't you tell us about that one?
That's my brothers. Years ago, they decided they were going to come from Norway over here on a visit. And this was fall time. I have a cabin in Port Fredrik in what they call Nickaby. We spent some time there. We stopped by a lake and we collected some big Canadian hunkers, which in Norway, they are not very common.
Now that must have been a great trip to have them visit.
Yeah, it was. very, very neat.
Throughout this, you've mentioned a couple times about your kids and how you've shared your interest in the outdoors with them. That's been an important part of it for you?
Yeah, very. From the time they started school, they would always help in the evening to not really skin furs, but turn them on the boards and clean up the furs. And then when they got a little older, they built a road up on Hoona Mountain. The oldest one got himself a little snowmobile, and he had a little trap line up there. I don't think he was more than probably 11, 12 years old. For several years, his trap line would produce anywhere from 25 to 30 marten in a winter. They took to deer hunting soon as they were old enough to carry a gun or go along to watch. They have never quit. They still are doing it. Especially the youngest one. He goes sheep hunting, moose hunting. He was stationed up in Kodiak that one year, and he went hunting, and they had a contest. The biggest buck up there would get a new rifle. As luck would have it, he got a big buck up there, and he had entered the contest, and he won it that year. He got a head mount for that deer, and that's about the prettiest head mount I ever seen. Kodiak do have a little more massive deer than they have in Southeastern. They were transplanted from Southeastern to Kodiak, but they're still more of massive, heavier. I don't think too many people up there would climb a mountain and put a whole deer on their back.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground here, all the different species and all your different activities. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion?
Coming from Norway over here, the country is very similar, except there's a big difference here. In Norway, if you were not a big landowner, you were not going to do much hunting. Over there, the fishing license is a new license for any new rubber. If you move a mile away, you got to have a new license, which in the state of Alaska, you buy a fishing license that covers the whole state, and the same with the hunting license, and everybody here is entitled to, if they want to go deer hunting or sheep hunting or goat hunting, that you have an opportunity to do it. That's why I have spent 50 years around here, and I hope I spend a little bit longer.
I just love the way he summed up his feelings. Okay, that's the last of our material from Joar Sovland. Let's go to a commercial break. Those sponsors make this program possible. We appreciate their support. Now let's go to the first part of an interview with Ken Fanning of Yakutat. Longtime Fairbanks residents can remember when Ken lived here in the Golden Heart City. In this first segment, Ken talks about his youth and how he made the trip to Alaska. He also shares memories of one of the infamous hunting guides that he worked with.
Okay, well, I was born in Florida. My dad was in the military at the time. And so obviously, most of my younger life, I was a military brat. We traveled around, and I think I was in Florida for 6 months and then went to Germany and various military bases in the United States. We were in Cheyenne, Wyoming as I was late in elementary school, and then we moved to Massachusetts, and it was there, I guess, that I started my first trap line when I was 14 or 15 and trapping muskrats. You know, my dad was always interested in the outdoors, and I suppose he was the central figure that got me to be involved in early days fishing and hunting. He wasn't a real super active outdoorsman, but I always was particularly interested in it. When he retired from the service, we moved to Denver, Colorado, and that's where I graduated from high school and took my first guide and outfitting job after my senior year in high school, before I went to college, and I started college at the Colorado State University in Fisheries and Wildlife Management. And back in those days, a prerequisite for a bachelor's degree was 6 months of related field service. So if I applied and got a job at the end of my sophomore year with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And, of course, didn't have any money, and so I hitchhiked from Colorado out to Seattle, Washington, and I knew there were boats headed to Alaska there in Seattle, and just walked up and down the wharfs and met up with an old codger named Bill Love on a boat named the Whidbey. Told me he would get me as far as Petersburg, Alaska, if I'd help him paint the boat for 10 days. So we painted and repaired the boat, and cargo was 504 cases of Lucky Lager beer for the harbor bar in Petersburg, and we had 10 days of the most incredible, beautiful weather on the Inside Passage, and I was destined for the Kwijak, and I was supposed to be on a sockeye weir. But of course, I just knew that any place in Alaska was closer to that destination than Colorado. And Fair and Bill was quite a crick robber, and I was going to work for the Fish and Game. The Fish and Game was about his worst enemy, and so he had told me every kind of story that you could imagine in that 10-day period while we had to, of course, take care of the breakage of the beer bottles on the way up. When we got there, he said, well, there's no sense in you going up to Bristol Bay. You know, I'm sure they need Fish and Game help here. And so I think that was the first time in his life he had voluntarily walked into the Fish and Game office in Petersburg and said, hey, this kid ought to work down here instead of going up there. And it turned out that they did need temporary help. So I started working for the Fish and Game out of Petersburg and Wrangell. And within a week or two, being on a boat and pulling crab pots and drinking beer and seeing and smelling and feeling and enjoying what was Alaska, if you like, hunting and fishing the way I did, why, it became very obvious to me that I didn't need to be going back to Colorado. So it turned out I did finish working for the department that year, and then went commercial fishing for a couple weeks on fall dogs, and I went back and finished the next school year. My wife came up, we were married then, and she came up and worked in the cannery while I worked on the commercial fishing boat, and then she went back to Colorado to go to school. I came up and started at the University of Alaska with several side jobs and whatnot. Then we got married in 69, and our honeymoon was up the Alcan, and we went to Talkeetna, and we ran the Fairview Inn there for summer in Montana Creek Lodge, then moved to Fairbanks for the winter, where we both re-enrolled in school, I part-time and Jill full-time. And Jill did go ahead and graduate and get her teaching certificate. And I just kind of instantly began working several jobs. Of course, just hunting and fishing all we could. And we began a sport fishing operation down on the Gulcana River. And then I began assistant guiding for, I worked for five different guides. It was Ray Loshi and Lynn Castle and John Pangborn and Bob Elliott, Joe Want. Until I got my hunting guide's license, and I was already running the fishing operation and then trapping in the wintertime. And I didn't figure that the price that they paid me for any furs was any higher with a degree or without a degree. And the same was true with any of the hunting or fishing trips. And I knew by then what the pay was if you worked for the Department of Fish and Game, and I didn't think that was very good. But beyond that, I guess in that first year I'd had a couple of experiences. It became pretty obvious to me that I was not going to fit well working in the government or get as much time out in the field as I needed. And enjoying hunting and fishing and trapping as much as I did, and enjoying time in the wilderness as much as I did, I knew that the only way that I'd be able to satisfy that was to have folks to pay me to go hunting rather than
the other way around.
Yeah.
Now, you told a couple of good stories last night about working for Ray Loshi.
Back in those days was just after the same-day airborne law had gone into effect. Prior to that in Alaska, it was perfectly legal to fly and spot game and land and shoot it the same day you were airborne. So a lot of the fellows who had done that had trouble getting out of that mold. And back in those days, that was before the state of Alaska had a guide board or guide areas or anything like that. So everybody just kind of hunted where they wanted to, and particularly a lot of those flyboy guys would pick an area and take more hunters than they should and overshoot an area, and then the following year they could just move to a different area. And Moshe certainly fit in that category, and he was just an unbelievable pilot. Really felt obligated to get everybody all their animals all the time. So he used an airplane, and I, of course, was very young, and I'd been warned that he was a bandit, and I didn't want to do anything illegal. I never have hunted illegally and or trapped illegally. I've always kind of thought that one of the great things about hunting and fishing and trapping, particularly in Alaska, is you're frequently in areas that are beyond the reach of the law. So the only decision to be made is a decision between you and the animal and God. And, you know, you just got this moral judgment that you get to make. If you want to violate the law in a place where you know there is nobody watching, you certainly have the option to do that. So you have the unique opportunity to develop a moral responsibility when you know no one's watching. We all know that as kids we're on our best behavior when our grandparents are around, when our friends are around, when other people are watching. But whenever you're in the wilderness, whether it's hunting or trapping and you're by yourself, you're making all those moral decisions yourself. I'd always held a pretty strict moral code, and I always believed in fish and wildlife management, and I always respected the critters that we were pursuing. And Loshi didn't have that problem. He just took animals, and his idea was to go get them, period. He would just tell the hunters when they came into camp that, hey, we're going to hunt illegally. The Fish and Game's all screwed up, and they passed a bunch of rules that make it so that it's hard for me to get your animals. And so he would just load one or two hunters in the Super Cub and go spot sheep and land as close as he could. And sometimes that was a half mile, and sometimes that was 15 miles. It didn't matter. Then he'd take off with the hunters and shoot the rams and load them up and come home and get more hunters. He was 54, I think, at the time, and he had just married a gal that was 18. She and I didn't get along at all, so I would quite frequently take the other hunters in camp and go out for caribou or moose or whatever and just camp out overnight because I didn't enjoy being in camp and, be hunting on foot. I just always believed in fair chase hunting and always have enjoyed it. that's kind of the way that season went. In that time, we've hunted first in the Brooks Range for sheep and caribou, and then we hunted in the Alaska Range for moose and caribou and grizzly and sheep and wolf. And then we went down on the peninsula for brown bear and moose and caribou. I think that ended by November. And in that time frame, I think he had gone through 13 or 14 assistant guides. I was the only guy that had lasted the whole season. And I know that the entire time he thought I was a fish and game plant, which I wasn't, but I just was not going to be involved in the shenanigans inside parks or same day airborne and that kind of thing. And I wasn't. And I learned more about skinning and fleshing and turning lips and ears and handling meat in that four-month period than I have in the subsequent 30 years of a very wonderful and successful and enjoyable hunt guiding career. But, you know, he was dealing with 6 to 12 hunters a week, every week, and really turning game. It was like an African expedition. And the challenge to him was not to get the game. The challenge to him was to be able to do it and violate the law without getting caught. And he was very, very good at that and never slept. And he outflew and outguessed and outmaneuvered every fish and game warden or federal agent or anybody that was trying to nab him. Like I said, we didn't have areas. So Loshi and Thompson and Hayes and Sims and those guys, what they did is they just claimed and developed their own exclusive areas where there was nobody else hunting, and what that meant was inside national parks. So if you hunted inside a national park, you probably didn't have any other guide competition. But anyway, that was my first experience, and that taught me a lot of real valuable lessons in dealing with people and also in things that I really didn't like about the industry and that I didn't want to pursue or emulate. At the same time, I learned an awful lot about animals and about skinning and saw a great variety of country in the state.
You mentioned at one point, almost in passing, about your trapping experiences. And for those of us in the Trappers Association, we know that you were one of the key people in the early days of that organization. So tell us a little bit about your trapping experiences and your involvement with the Trappers Association.
I don't remember exactly what year we started the Interior Alaska Trappers Association.
In 73, I think.
Was it 73? Okay. So there probably were a few of us before that, Ron Long and Fabian Carey, and a few guys split off from the Tanana Valley Sportsmen Association, not split off, but I mean who had met there and felt that there was a need for a Trappers Association. There was a lot of talk going around about trap line registrations and, you know, some of the issues that I'm sure they're probably still issues today. And I enjoyed trapping, and I was obviously, like a lot of folks, originally a recreational trapper. And I think that in my entire career, I was always a recreational trapper. It happens that I did it full time for 5 or 6 years, but I caught so few animals that anybody else would say that it was recreational trapping. It sure as hell wasn't a way to make a living. It was a good way to make a young wife very mad. But I really enjoyed it, and I spent a lot of time on the trap line and had the great pleasure of trapping 1 year for Ron Long. Frequently, if he had to go on buying trips or whatnot, I'd end up taking over his trap line for, you know, whatever period he'd be gone to for auctions or whatnot. Started my own line down in Menno Flats on the Chattanooga and Tatlanica and that area, and had about a 100-mile line that was primarily for fox and lynx and marten and mink and a few wolf and wolverine. But like I say, I ended up not setting any records in the amount of fur that I caught, but I probably did set a record for the amount of time spent to catch fur, and I really did enjoy it. Norm Phillips taught me how to beaver trap, and I helped him a little bit, and then he helped me, and so we always took a limited beaver for my wife and I each year in the flats there in March and early April. And I started with snow machines, and I would go off Murphy Dome, and go down to the cabins on the Chattanooga River, and be gone usually for 3 to 4 days to a week, and then back in town for 2 or 3 days. At that time, we had a little log cabin on Chena Pump Road. We had no running water and wood heat. By that time, I'd had problems that everybody does with snow machines, and you know, you only need to walk back 30 or 40 miles half a dozen times in your life to realize that that's not a fun thing to do at 30 or 40 or 50 below. And I got a picture, I still have it to this day, from the top of Murphy Dome when I had two snow machines that were broke down about 30 miles out in the flats, and the only way I could get them back was I had to get Pete Buist and his dog team to drag my snow machines back in. So then I decided, of course, that I was going to switch to dogs. So I ended up getting some good dogs and the following year, and I think we had 22 dogs. Out of those, I had 3 or 4 that were reasonably intelligent. The rest of them did an excellent job of eating and shitting, but they sure as hell weren't very smart, and they were mostly pretty lazy, but Sister Alice was an incredible lead dog that did a good job. I had 25 dogs when I left, and I had 52 when I came back 3 months later, and a wife that was had moved in town because she was so damn mad at feeding my dogs at 50 below while I was off fighting the politicians in Washington, D.C. on the Alaska Lands Bill, and that's when I went out of the dog business, right then and there. But those early memories, and I don't regret any of those things, they were a tough and really poor way to make a living economically, but they were a wonderful way to see and feel in Alaska that few people in the world get to do anymore. My trap line was pretty much always by myself. I would occasionally have a partner for short periods of time, but mostly I ran the trap line by myself. We went through that period where there wasn't any steel and there were no traps being produced in the United States, and so we took a big truck back and stopped at every trap supply house from the East Coast to here and brought back some sawn hickory for dog sleds and loaded the flatbed up with traps and started a little trap supply business that I ran out of the little log cabin garage I had there on the pump road for a year or two. And all the meantime, then in the summertime, I'm running guided fishing trips, then beginning the hunting operation.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Alaska Tracks. Tune in again next week when we will continue with more stories from Ken Fanning of Yakutat.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.